everybody. Welcome to episode 732 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Webtoon Wednesday episode, and today I'm going to be discussing with creator Dan Scotti his Webtoon strip called Lavender Jack. Really enjoyed this one. It's a real throwback. It feels timeless. It feels a little crime noir. It feels a little inspired by Sherlock Holmes and Mark Waid's Ruse from CrossGen. So, yeah, there's a lot there, and it was a pleasure to have Dan on. I think that we really dive into some behind-the-scenes sort of stuff with the story, and I really feel like the interview with Dan enhances the reading experience. I think if you listen to this interview first and then go read the story, you're going to get so much more out of it. So, again, thanks to Dan for joining. I hope you all enjoy the interview, and we'll talk to you next time. All right, everyone. Thank you for joining me for another Webtoon Wednesday. I have a creator on today to talk about his strip on Webtoon, Lavender Jack, which I really enjoyed. It's not too far down the path. I think there's about 30 episodes or so out, so plenty of time to catch up. But I want to welcome Dan Scotti to the show. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I was really enjoying the strip. It has sort of this kind of timeless feel, a little bit of a Sherlock Holmes mystery, maybe a Mark Waid ruse from CrossGen. So yeah, I was very intrigued. I really enjoyed what you've released so far.
Man, you were the first person to bring up Ruse, and you're totally right. I loved that book when it came out. Its fingerprints are definitely on Lavender Jack.
Wow, that's great. Well, probably because I was such a big fan of it and CrossGen too. So we'll get into the book in a minute, but I always like to ask people when they first come on kind of about their history with comics. How did they discover them? Did you grow up reading them? What's your secret origin, so to speak?
Well, I definitely loved comics growing up. I remember being six, and the one time that my ma took me to that like sketchy comic shop in the mall, it was like so exciting for me, because I would see the posters of like Spawn and whatever on the windows as we walked past to go to the supermarket, and I'd be like, oh man, there's like so much weird stuff in there. I want to know what it's like. And of course we came out with like the tamest issue of Spider-Man, but of just knowing that I was finally going to figure out what was going on inside there was very, very exciting. And, you know, as a kid, I really latched on to comics. I was just sort of an artistic kid. So I liked drawing the characters, and like, I liked figuring out like the idea that you could draw a figure from different angles other than just like the men's room logo, that you could draw figures like crouching and running, climbing up walls and things, was like a light bulb moment for 6-year-old Dan Scotti. And that never really went away.
So, but you've been a lifelong fan then, it's fair to say.
Definitely. Just the comics is like the one thing throughout being a student and an adult, it's like the one thing that I would always reliably be able to get into. It's sort of that one constant in my interests.
Now, can you remember when you kind of started contemplating, well, maybe I can make my own comic, maybe I can become a creator, get on the other side of the fence, so to speak?
I think that would probably be in middle school, where, like, obviously when I was a kid, I understood that people drew these books and worked in them, but it wasn't until middle school when my school librarian introduced me to Neil Gaiman comics that I was getting a bunch of different types of stories that were branded as coming from this writer. Like the writer was almost more important in the comics. And that somehow made it tangible to me. And that made me start looking at comics as a craft, trying to determine the things that marked the style of this writer or this artist. And as soon as you start thinking that way, the next logical thought is like, well, maybe it could be me then. So yeah, thank you. Tanya Sepulveda was the school librarian who turned me on to Sandman.
Wow, that's a pretty heady read too at that young age.
Yeah, I don't know all the details, but I do know that she was no longer the librarian the year after that. There may be some connection, I'm not sure. But while she was there, she definitely made a big impact on me.
Now, have you only worked digitally, or have you had published work like in print media? What's some other, if you have any other previous work that some of our listeners may be familiar with?
Well, I've been working in comics full-time for about 5, maybe 6 years now. And for a good portion of that, I was drawing completely traditionally. I drew, I did 12 issues of The Spirit over at Dynamite. That was 270-some pages that were all drawn completely traditionally by me. The comic that I kind of broke in with, San Hannibal, that was completely traditionally drawn. And it wasn't until, I think just 2 years ago, where so my studio mates at Helioscope, a comics art studio in Portland, when I was living there, that they kind of took me aside and said, you know, we respect that you like doing things traditionally, but going forward, you're going to need to know how to do things digitally. And so they forced me to learn what was then called Manga Studio. It's called Clip Studio now. And taking everything I learned from working traditionally, the limitations, the permanence of working traditionally, and then applying the freedom of digital tools was a huge, that was as big a light bulb as 6-year-old Dan figuring out that you could draw people from different angles. Like it was this moment where I realized that I could really apply some of the theories of art that I've been thinking about in new, exciting, fluid, and most importantly, non-permanent ways.
And at what point did you start thinking about not necessarily working on properties that weren't your own, but coming up with your own ideas? I mean, as a comics reader growing up and an artistic person, a creative person, you must have always sort of had these ideas of your own stories that you wanted to tell. Is that right?
Oh, definitely. When I was probably 10 or so, I would write these comics with original characters, you know, like little kid characters, like Gadget Man and Captain Elastic and whatnot. And I'd draw them in pencil on blue line paper and use my mom's photocopier to make extremely small print runs of them. And I, at one point, tried selling them door to door in my neighborhood for 25 cents a copy. So I was, from the jump, from the inception, I was trying to figure out, okay, how can I get a hold of some IPs and then turn that into revenue? And I never really stopped doing that. Like obviously, like everybody who works in traditional comics, you know, mainstream comics, you want to work on properties you know and like. Like, of course, working on The Spirit was huge for me because I'm a gigantic fan of The Spirit and Will Eisner in general. But you also, like, you want to take the energy that comes from working on those, you know, known properties and apply them to something that's yours.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, let's get into some details about Lavender Jack here. You can tell our listeners what it's all about.
Well, Lavender Jack, which updates every Tuesday on Webtoon, is a mystery adventure series set in the early 20th century about a masked burglar who goes into the homes of the wealthy to steal their damning documents, their secrets, scare the hell out of them, and then air their dirty laundry to the world, ruining them socially and financially. Some of these rich people decided that they didn't want that to keep happening to them, and so they, you know, begged the Lord Mayor of the city of Gallery, where all this takes place, to do something about it. Do something. We're getting handed out here. Will you please do something? And the Lord Mayor, who's this kind of silly, you know, shallow, goofy little man-child, decides that he'll use this as an opportunity to do something he's always wanted to do, which is hire his hero, this this public figure that he's admired forever, Teresa Ferrier, the great detective. He hires her to come to the gallery and figure out who is Lavender Jack. And there's a couple complications to this. One is that Teresa Ferrier is now in her 60s and her career has hit kind of the skids, which is bad for her because her wife, Marguerite, is suffering from a brain tumor and needs very expensive medical procedures to stay alive. It's also bad because the Lord Mayor is in the employ of a seriously scary underworld figure named Lady Hawthorne, who's very displeased that he's tried to handle the situation this way and is now taking things into her own hands, which is going to have disastrous ramifications for pretty much everybody involved. And that's Lavender Jack, and I'm really into it. And other people seem to be too, and that's pretty cool for me.
Sorry, my dogs are... I think my wife might be home. So, you know, I mentioned Mark Waid's Ruse, and that clearly is an inspiration. Maybe some Sherlock Holmes elements there. Poirot would be another. Were these...
Definitely.
...kind of stories and characters that you had read growing up? Like, they were... Some like that type of storytelling always interested you, because it is so much different than a lot of the traditional like comic book superhero stuff that we grow up reading, Spider-Man, Batman, Superman, that kind of thing. It's in a completely different vein, right?
It is. I've always had a real thing for detective stories. When I was a kid, I loved the Granada Television Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes. Which was kind of grounded and realistic. And also it had this kind of sensitive edge to it. You know, Holmes, in a lot of American stuff, Holmes gets depicted as this, you know, this logic robot. He's like a cranky Data. But in the Granada Sherlock Holmes, he's like, you kind of see his heart a little bit more. And you, especially as the series went on, you saw his fatigue. As both Holmes, the character, got older and Jeremy Brett, the actor, got older. And I liked that. I liked that human side to these detective stories. And that would, you know, easily transition into really being into a hard-boiled detective fiction. You know, Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade, these novels that would become the basis for all those film noir movies that were all about detectives like getting the crap kicked out of them trying to solve cases. And that's like that agony, that human heart of somebody trying to solve a mystery really resonated with me. And of course, all of that is stuff you also get in things like Batman and Daredevil. So I really gravitated towards those comics as well, The Question. So I think that this kind of story, you know, it's this more geared towards the mystery genre than the action genre is still very, like, it's very much a comic book thing. It's just focusing on a different part of comics history than what people typically think of as like superhero comics.
Well, I love this idea too of something you said there that really kind of stuck with me is the idea of introducing some sort of human frailty, some heart, some emotion into these characters, like Sherlock Holmes, right? Who you really only mostly see. I mean, in the original novels, there's some humanity to him, but a lot of the early adaptions, certainly, he comes across as this larger than life figure who's doesn't have the frailties and, you know, foibles of the human condition, and it makes it tough to relate as the reader, right? You can't really ever put yourself in Sherlock Holmes' shoes, so to speak, because you don't have the touch points. That's one of the things about your story. These characters are flawed in a way, and in that way, they become more relatable. So, was it something that you did purposefully, or was it just kind of inherent as you were developing the characters and inherent to your kind of storytelling style?
Well, it was very much something I wanted to do personally, purposefully. You know, the whole genesis of the Lavender Jack character was, you know, what if we took the conventional, you know, masked man exposes crimes superhero type story, but kind of plopped it in the world of the kind of silly characters you'd find in a Jeeves and Wooster story. And that immediately means you're introducing, you know, this kind of goofy, fallible aspect to the superhero story. And I wanted to expand that in sort of the more serious fallibility, the more serious humanity of the characters. Like you crack the door open with just the innate kind of silliness of doing, you know, Arrow and Downton Abbey. And then that allows you to, like, well, while you're laughing at goofy characters like the Lord Mayor, you can see, you know, the pain and the sort of the exhaustion of Teresa Ferrier. You see sort of the internal conflict in Sir Memley, who is secretly Lavender Jack. Don't tell anybody. And I think that all of that works together to make the mystery more interesting, because the mystery isn't real. Like none of these crimes actually happened. The City of Gallery doesn't even exist. So if there isn't emotional context, if you aren't kind of pulling for these characters, even when they're on opposite ends of a conflict, if you're not wanting everybody to make it out okay, then the mystery is just, it might as well be a logic puzzle on a test.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Jeeves and Bertie Wooster stories. And I did get a lot of that feel here too, but it almost seems like you took a lot of the characters and the situations from those. It was P.G. Wodehouse that wrote them, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's almost like you were channeling him in a way, but you took a lot of kind of the archetypes that he worked with, and you kind of shook them up and kind of distributed, because I see different aspects of Bertie in several characters. And same thing with Jeeves. You know, we've got it with Honoria, who's sort of the local detective that's hoping to solve this crime, but there's some of it in Madame Ferrier as well. So was that something that you think was purposeful on your part, or is it just the fact that I know you're a fan of Wodehouse, so it's almost inherent in your creative DNA, so to speak.
It's true. I definitely liked the idea. Like, in my mind, the City of Gallery was basically just the setting of the Wodehouse stories right up until the point that Lavender Jack hits the scene and starts messing things up for people. Like, it probably was a very kind of safe, silly place beforehand. And Honoria Crabb even has some dialogue in one of the earlier episodes about how, like, Gallery is not a dangerous place to live. Things work pretty well here, with the subtext being, so why are people like Lavender Jack or Teresa Ferrier trying to shake things up? And what we're seeing over the course of the series is what happens when, you know, an idyllic kind of safe place for the rich people gets upset, and all of a sudden the people who were comfortable and were safe are now scrambling.
Yeah, all of a sudden that seems like such a relevant idea too, and I want to talk a little bit about that. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about the time period that you've placed the story in, because it's so intentionally vague, and a lot of times when a writer will do that, they just won't mention it at all. They won't mention a time period, and they just kind of leave it up to the reader to sort of guess. But you put right there in the first episode, I can't remember exactly how you worded it, but something about it's in the time period of 19 something or other. So you kind of put it right there in the beginning for the reader to know that, okay, we're not going to say exactly when it is. But I think as a side effect of that, you've given it sort of this timeless quality. Can you talk a little bit about the decision and the thought process into the setting as far as the time period?
Certainly. Yeah, that was definitely meant to give it this timeless quality. And it was also meant to, to help the audience separate what's happening in this story from real world history. Because, you know, we're dealing with fictional countries, and we're also dealing with, you know, a social development that wasn't really present back then. We're dealing with technology that wasn't present back then. So by coding it as happening in the Edwardian era, but not saying it happened in May of 1908, we help people like engage with the setting while not making them like bend their brains into pretzels trying to figure out, you know, how this squares with real world events, which it totally doesn't. And it also just gives the comic a levity that I think it's good for the tone and helps people ease into it. Some people get off put by period pieces. You know, when the movie starts, we fade in big letters. It's like, you know, 1897. And they're like, shoot, I don't know what happened back then. I'm not going to get the references. They're going to say weird stuff. Are there cars yet? I don't know. So that was an attempt by me to smooth that transition for the readers.
And have you had a lot of...
So it was three of those things.
And have you had a lot of feedback from readers that they like that? Is it something that people are sort of noticing it? Or is it? Do you think it's more of subtle for your readers?
I think it's probably more subtle because I think that people in general, especially, you know, people who are used to reading comics, are pretty comfortable just rolling with the vagueness of the setting. I think there's a reason that a lot of independent comics, especially independent superhero comics, are just set in the city. Because people kind of get it, and they don't need that specificity. What has been fun is I have gotten some responses in the comments and on social media from readers trying to get more information about what Gallery is. Like, where is it in Europe? Is it part of another country, or is it its own state? Is it landlocked? Like, I've gotten several different requests for maps from people, which is exciting. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, it seems like they're kind of invested in the setting. And I think part of that is that it is so interesting, you can't help but wonder. You've created a rich world, I think, where you have a wealth of characters and perhaps other stories to tell in this setting, you know, even if it's kind of beyond the walls of Gallery, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. We definitely wanted to put a lot of effort into making the city feel full. And if anything, I wish I had been a little bit smarter earlier on and made it feel fuller sooner. I'm a big believer that a story feels very, very small, very quickly if you don't sink a little bit of time and budget into just putting humanity around the plot. So many, this is a beef I have with a lot of detective TV shows, is they're usually pretty cheaply made, so they don't pay for enough extras, and it starts feeling like it's the same dozen people in blood feuds with each other. And it makes everything just feel less important.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's important to have that central cast, but it's also, if you want it to feel realistic, the real world is diverse, you've got to inhabit it with a lot of different characters that are coming in and out of the storyline, really.
Very true. My girlfriend and I have been rewatching Twin Peaks, and that's something that we're really impressed with, is just how interconnected the town feels with just little characters who just do one memorable thing and they're gone forever. It's not hard. You have to decide to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of characters, can you give a little more detail on your two kind of the main adversarial characters? We've talked a little bit about Madame Ferrier, but there's something that's kind of inherent to where she is that I would like you to kind of give us a little more detail on. And that's kind of this idea of her, she's being past her prime, you know, she's tired. And then also Lavender Jack, what can you tell us about, like, kind of his motivations, if you will?
Sure. So as the series kicks off, your two big opposing forces are, you know, Madame Ferrier, the great detective who's a little over the hill, and Lavender Jack, this, you know, flamboyant, acrobatic, masked, vigilante criminal, and, you know, sort of this dashing outlaw versus this old lawman. And in putting those characters together, I, along with Jen Manley Lee, who colors the strip, and Becca Caden, who was my editor at the beginning, we put a lot of effort into making sure that they had a chemistry together, even though they weren't going to be on panel together for a while. And it's structural things like, you know, Madame Ferrier she works mostly within the system and works slowly. She's got this kind of mountainous quality to her thinking, or glacial, where she moves slowly but deliberately, whereas Jack is always like coming in through windows and dropping in from above. He's agile. He's more of a fire type character. Lavender Jack is an athletic young man. Madame Ferrier is an aging woman. You know, Lavender Jack is all like angles and claws and horns and things. And Madame Ferrier is, you know, rounded with these sloped shoulders. And all of that was designed so that these two elements felt like they were building up charge in their own parallel stories. So when they finally meet, there's this feeling of an elemental clash. And that's been really exciting, to write because they don't share a lot of screen time together, their voices get to develop independent of each other. So when they finally talk, they feel so like fully dimensional, which is very exciting, for me, because I've never done that before as a writer. And it also has the benefit of making it that the series has good narrative variety. You know, the Lavender Jack sections are a lot more action-packed, and they're also a lot quieter, if he's normally sort of out on his own. And the Ferrier sections are a little bit, they have a different energy to it. And the hope is that makes the series feel like, again, that it's big, and that whenever you check the new update every week, you don't quite know what the energy is going to be. You know, it's going to feel like the Lavender Jack series. It's going to have the bright colors. It's going to have the sort of like the funny heightened speech, and it's going to have the black heavy stylings, but you don't really know what the flavor is going to be. And, I find that exciting as a creator, and hopefully people find that exciting as readers.
Yeah, so I did notice that when I was reading it, and it kind of reminds me of the best kind of novels when it's a more of an ensemble cast and you have a lot of different like plot threads going, and the author will devote a chapter to one particular plot thread, and you're really into it, and just as you can't wait for more, the chapter ends and you start the next chapter and it's a completely different thread, and you're disappointed maybe for that first half page because you wanted more of that other thread, right? You were so invested. And then you start the new thread, and then by the time you're two pages in, then you're invested in that thread. And when that chapter ends and you go back to the other one that you thought you wanted, you're like, well, wait a second. And that's how I feel about sort of the pacing of Lavender Jack, because you're right, the Lavender Jack pages are so kind of energetic and kind of fun and so kind of filled with energy, right? And the Ferrier pages are more kind of intellectual, and even the speech mm-hmm. patterns you're using are it's more methodical, more meticulous in a way, and you can kind of engage that part of your brain. And so I think you're doing a great job of showing the difference between these two characters, and that difference even extends to kind of the look of them. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But has it been a challenge to write in those two different styles for this story?
It has been. It makes me happy to hear that it's working for you. And I think it works more than it doesn't. But it has been tricky sometimes to to not let one lead into the other. Mm-hmm. There are times when I write fairy or something that's a little too like catty and too clever, so I take that out. Times when Lavender Jack or Ducky, his partner, will say something that's a little too like metaphysical, mm-hmm. a little too deep. I'm like, okay, that has to go. Because if you're not careful with that as a writer, you start being one of those writers that is always kind of talking in the same voice, no matter who the characters are.
Yep.
And that's what makes a story feel didactic. It makes it feel like you're being, lectured to. You got to keep the separate voices separate so that you get that wonderful energy from their contrast. That's all storytelling is contrast. And I think that's very true of character, even just as much as it's true of, the black and white balance.
Has it gotten easier as you've kind of gotten into it to keep them separate?
Yeah, it has. I definitely have a better sense of their voices. Like earlier on, I would write Lavender Jack as like a little meaner than I write him now. And Farrier was a little bit more, she did more like Poirot things, or a little more of like, what is the word? Or like just these little, foreign detective tics. But it's kind of weaned out now that both I'm more comfortable writing her, and also she's now more comfortable talking with Inspector Crabbe or the other characters that she's gotten to know. And that's been really fulfilling. Because I really love Teresa Farrier. She's one of my, she might be my favorite character that I've ever created. And it's been fulfilling to see her go from this like tired outsider who doesn't really want to be there, doesn't feel like she can really connect with anybody, and see her have the courage to like take a chance on people. And now she's actually building a community. I almost get a little choked up thinking about it, that she would keep trying. Like even though she's, in a bad spot in her life right now, at 60 with her prospects dwindling, she's not going to let that keep beating her. I find that really encouraging, and it seems like other people do as well. I feel like I'm ending a lot of thoughts with that. I like it. I think other people will too. But that's seriously a thing that occupies a lot of my thoughts. When I'm making creative decisions, I'm thinking, okay, I'm responding to this. Why is that? Might someone else also respond to that?
So what I find so interesting, and it's especially true of a lot of the webtoon creators that I have on, it's about, and I think it has to do with kind of the format and the schedule, kind of the size of the amount of work that's released on a weekly basis. So you're constantly living with these creations just due to the way the release schedule works. But I find that any challenges that are there in the beginning, that as it starts to become easier, I think what it is that these creations, once you've given them birth and sort of taught them how to walk, to keep it as that kind of a comparison, once they start having a life of their own and they're able to kind of move and start living and breathing, then that's when you as a creator start hearing them speak to you. And then that's where the comfort level comes in, right? Like you are hearing her voice now. You're hearing the voice of Madame Fair. You're hearing the voice of Lavender Jack. And so at this point, it almost becomes easier to know what they would do and what they wouldn't do, which I think has to make it a little easier for you as the creator to continue writing their story. Would you say that's true?
I would say it's true, yes. And I do caution people, creators, against phrasing it as I hear the characters talk to me or they would do this, they wouldn't do this. The phrase, like, the characters start to tell me what to do. I think that's emotionally true, but it surrenders too much of your power as a creator to the process. is the characters feel more real to you, and you feel like you know what they do because they've now done a lot of things, and your brain is drawing the patterns between them, and it now is able to draw things into that pattern and see, ah, this does fit, this doesn't fit. So if you give too much of your authority over to sort of the weird, you know, mystic deep brain way of thinking that's out of your control, then I feel like you're more susceptible to things like writer's block, or you become more defensive of your decisions because they weren't my decisions. It's what the characters needed.
Right.
A little bit of that is good because it keeps you emotionally invested in what you're writing. But too much of it, I think, like anything, leads to problems.
So it's more about kind of recognizing, as you said, the pattern, and then you can see when something's incongruous and it doesn't fit. Like, why is that here? That doesn't fit in with the puzzle, the picture that I'm painting, basically.
Yeah. I think it's very important to kind of have an artist's heart, you know, this kind of romantic, you know, viewpoint into creativity, but to keep your mind in more of a, like, a procedural engineer type mind space.
Right. The technical aspects of storytelling.
Yeah. There's some song, its title is something like, you know, dream like an artist, think like a policeman. I'm butchering it. It's this old folk song. I can't remember it, but I think that keeping those halves of yourself in play is the key to being an effective, healthy creator.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. Well, you were talking, before when you were breaking down the characters about, the way Lavender Jack is, you know, kind of the fire character. You know, he's very elusive, a lot of angles and such. And Farrier, you know, her thinking is more meticulous, more purposeful, maybe even plotting at some points. Not to say she's not intelligent or sharp thinking, but it's just and you use the word kind of mountainous. And it's interesting because you're describing their personalities and the way they come across on the page, but you're also describing the way they look, right? The visual difference between the two. So did you develop the visual look for the two characters along with the personalities, or did one kind of inform the other? Like, what was that process like as far as the visual development?
The idea that they would, because originally I was kind of building towards like a fist fight between them in the very, very beginning when I first spotted these characters. That was generally the idea, that you know, they would come to a physical altercation. And so in my head, I was thinking of, you know, the big sturdy fighter versus the like lithe agile fighter, and that was at the bedrock of both of the characters. It also helps that Jack pulls from superheroes. He pulls from Spring Hill Jack. He pulls from even Bertie Wooster is like a sprightly, like, as I'm talking right now, I like straighten my back and put my hands on my hips. Like, he's that kind of character in terms of his personality. And Farrier draws from detectives. She draws from a lot of older detectives who are seated, who have sloped shoulders, who like lean on canes. And so I think that those really had deep marks on their characters from the very beginning, and everything kind of built on that.
So
and all the other characters in between are some permutation of that. You know, the angular, like daggery Lavender Jack is paired with like the almost elfish Ducky, who's very, like, she's in the same vein as his look. You know, Madame Farrier, her wife, Marguerite, is always seated and has this long, like, thick hair that's always hanging down. Like, they have familiars that echo their motifs.
I hadn't noticed that. I'm going to have to go back and look a little more closely. So when you went to develop them visually, was it a relatively quick process then? Because you kind of knew the way you wanted them to, like, basically the inspirations that were informing their look? Or was it a process of, here's, well, maybe this is working and maybe this is not, and you kind of dialed it in slowly over time?
I think that Farrier, both of them, their basic designs got nailed down pretty quick, but it took a while, I think, for them to really really click. Like Lavender Jack, at first, was a little more ornamental. Like his mask had these little arabesques on them, and there was like more costuming to his costume. And then that had to go because it weighed him down. Farrier also was at first a little bit more hawkish. Like she had more angles to her. And so I smoothed those out. And so instead of a hawk, she's more like a vulture. And it also took me a long time to figure out how I could make her face look like dense and, you know, kind of strange and bizarre, but keep her, intelligence present. That's one thing earlier on that if we get a chance to do a collected edition, I'll probably alter a little bit. I'll go back and make some revisions. Because she looks a little dim at some points earlier on when I just want her to be tired. Mm. And it took me, I wasn't until like probably episode 7 or so before Farrier started feeling like the wise, weary mountain I wanted her to look like.
Yeah, I would say that she, there is sort of I wouldn't say a shift, but I did notice that she seemed a little softer in her features as the story goes on. And I kind of took that to be that she started feeling more comfortable in the town of Galleria, in the city, and with those around her. But, you know, it could be, like you said, you just got a little more comfortable as a creator in depicting her the way you wanted to.
I do think that's kind of a happy accident. She does start to look more like herself. The more like herself she starts behaving, and so, but that kind of worked out. But I also feel like early on, the way I was drawing her was getting in the way of people identifying with her. Mm. And I love the way she looks, and I wouldn't change her core design, but I would go back and change how I was drawing it earlier on. And that's not a problem anymore. People have really latched on to her, which really warms my heart that they're on board with her, and they want her to win. They want her wife to be okay. On the few occasions where we've done a cliffhanger where she's been in trouble, they've been really worried for her. So it's something's working there.
Well, that brings up an interesting point too, because I'm not sure who I don't know which one I like better. Am I rooting for Lavender Jack? Am I rooting for Fairy? They're both so likable, and their motivations are, I think, both admirable in a way. You know, it's just a matter of perspective, mm-hmm. and it goes back to that old cliche that we're all kind of the heroes of our own story. So clearly, Farrier thinks she's in the right, and Lavender Jack thinks what he's doing is right, and it makes for an interesting story because, again, there's no good guy or bad guy in this, in my mind. Was that something that you had in mind with the story you wanted to tell, where it was, who do we pick? Who do we choose? Which side are we on?
Yeah, I did want people to be able to pick their fighter because I think that's more interesting. I think it's more interesting when you're invested in both sides of the conflict. And I also knew that there was going to be some like really bad guys in this. And so I wanted the readers to be able to like hope that Jack and Farrier were going to team up and fight them. That hasn't happened up till now. Every time that Farrier or Jack are the focus of an episode, in the comments is always multiple people going like, "Oh man, I hope they team up."
Yeah, it would be something to see for sure. We mentioned earlier about these the rich people, the kind of the upper crust of the Galleria and society here. having committed these terrible crimes. And that's really what Lavender Jack is doing. He's, exposing some of his own, so to speak. And in a way, I feel like there's some political relevance to, like, at least what's going on in the United States anyway, with the 1% and the disenfranchised, so to speak. And, especially with all daily scandals almost that we hear about in our political system. Was that something that you purposefully wanted to reference, or is it just a coincidence, basically?
It definitely became something I wanted to reference as developing the series went on. Mm. I was having a conversation with my friend Paul Guinan back when I was in Portland, and I was telling him about Lavender Jack. And Paul is the co-author of this book Boilerplate, which is about a robot who's made around the same time as Lavender Jack. So he's a big history buff, and he knows a bunch about this era of world history. And he was saying how a lot of people consider the Great Depression to be the final nail in the coffin of the idea of noblesse oblige, the idea that the wealthy are sort of beholden to the less powerful, that if you have money, if you have influence, part of the deal is you have to pay that back to the community. Mm-hmm. And the theory goes that, that started to wane a lot as the world became more industrialized, but also it really took a nosedive when, in the early part of the 20th century, a lot of people lost a bunch very quickly. And on the other side of that, people with money became a lot more conservative. This idea, I can't give too much away because I don't know if I'm going to lose a bunch all of a sudden, started to take root. So that got me thinking that, Mimley Bastrop / Lavender Jack, this aristocrat who we learned recently is the last of his family line, sole heir to this tremendous fortune, is this sort of, he is somebody whose core philosophy is essentially with great power comes great responsibility. And if you're very wealthy and powerful and protected, and you got that way, or you maintained that position by, raining abuse on those less powerful than you, the people less powerful than you have no recourse. They can't hurt you. That's the arrangement. They can't punch up. And so the only person who could hold them to account is somebody on their level. And the whole reason for the mask and the disguise that he and Ducky develop is that, if one rich guy just points to the others and goes, "Don't do that," they can point back at you and go, "Well, I don't know. We're part of the same system. Who are you to tell me?" But as this masked devil character, no one knows who he is, what his motivations are. They just know that he is holding you to account. He's holding you responsible for what you've done. And I think that's kind of an electric idea. And I think it's an idea that is kind of having a moment right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. And I also found it interesting that right off the bat, when our first clue that Ferrier is so sharp is when she comes in and there's that scene with her and Honoria where she's like, let's kind of go over what we know. And then right away she's all, it's somebody wealthy. She made that connection right away, and it's like, oh yeah, she knows her stuff for sure.
That's one of the things that's fun about Ferrier is she's the oldest character in the main cast of the series. And you get these senses that she's lived a lot of strange cases, and she's seen a lot of this before, and that she has this perspective, this sort of earned experience that's kind of beyond a lot of the other characters. And so she has this, especially earlier on, she has this kind of Ezekiel aspect of like, I know more about the world than you people do. I know you won't listen to me, but I am going to say what I think.
Yeah, it's almost like she's, what's the old cliche? I've forgotten more than you will ever know.
Exactly.
You know, the other thing that you've done expertly well, Dan, and I think, you know, in having this conversation with you and hearing about the way you've kind of designed it to have some episodes that are, you know, specifically about Lavender Jack and some that are more about Farrier. But it's the pacing, which I always think is an underrated part of sequential storytelling. I think it's one of the things that aspiring creators struggle with early on in their career, if they get to have a career, because it's the hardest thing to get right, because it's different than any other kind of creative medium, any other kind of writing, whether that be film, TV, prose, sequential storytelling. The pacing is so hard to get down, and you've really been kind of playing with the pacing a little bit. We get some episodes that are a lot of action and the strip just flies, and then some other we get it slows down and we get more character moments, whether that's between Lavender Jack and Ducky or Farrier kind of explaining her theories. So has that a challenge for you even at this stage of your career? Has it gotten easier as you've gone along with this particular strip? Talk to us a little bit about pacing.
Well, yes, it's absolutely a challenge. And yes, I feel like I'm getting better at it. And a big help with that earlier on was, again, the editorial influence of Becca Caden. Mm. For instance, early on in the strip, there's this little two-parter where Lavender Jack breaks into this hospital to discover, you know, some skullduggery that one of his targets is up to. That originally wasn't in the initial run of episodes. Lavender Jack, you know, in episode 3, he kind of terrorizes the Lord Mayor. And then he wasn't going to be seen again until the Solstice Festival ball on like episode 10. And it was Becca who said, well, you know, I see what you're doing. You're trying to like build up anticipation in between Jack showing up, you know, because you think you're Alan Moore, apparently. But the script's called Lavender Jack, and we should see him. We should see him, like, we should learn a little bit more about his attitude and where he's coming from, so that when we do see him again, it has some electricity to it, because we feel like we know him a little bit and can like have fun trying to figure out what he's going to do. So that was a pacing thing that Becca really helped me out with. And that's not the only example of such a thing. And so after she kind of helped me, you know, get the beat down for the first 10 episodes, that's when I started to feel like I had a better sense of what the ebb and flow was going to be. And as a result, as much as I think that the series is pretty good all throughout, but once we like get past episode 20 or so, I really feel like it starts to click. Mm-hmm. with a satisfying, you know, resounding plasticky click.
Yeah, and again, I go back to pacing, and it's something that I think even a lot of casual readers, when they'll say they don't like something, but they can't put their finger on it, I think it a lot of times it comes back to pacing, because if you ask a lot of people, a lot of comic readers, they'll just say, oh yeah, I want like action, 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 you know, pedal to the metal all the time. They don't realize that if you keep it like redlined the whole time and you don't have any kind of slowdown, then you can't have the impact. You know, if everything is like special, then nothing's special, right? If you keep it at the top all the time, then you have no appreciation for like the big reveals or the big beats, because you haven't had any valleys.
That's exactly it. Yeah, storytelling is all about contrast. It's anticipation. It's build up. It's payoff. It's cool down. If contrast wasn't important, then our lettering wouldn't be in black and white. Like it's you have to use your different tools against each other to create the hologram of the story. Because if everything is down tempo and drab, or if everything is exciting and 10 all the time, you actually shatter the illusion, because the reader starts to get fatigued. They start to realize, oh, it's just this.
Yep.
And you don't have any power over them anymore.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it for sure. I'm sure you have an ending in mind. You probably did right from the beginning. Do you have an idea of how many episodes this story is going to go?
Yeah. We have the first season planned out. We're past the halfway mark, but there's still a good chunk of it left. And I am very excited about the ending. I think that it finishes really well.
Yeah, not to get...
And if...
Go ahead.
Please, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, if the response is good, I have ideas of what a season two would be. There's definitely an opening for that. But I'm not thinking too much about that right now, because I'm really focused on the ending of this season, because it's an extremely spicy meatball.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, actually, if you had, because we talked about how rich this world is that you've created and how people are so interested in you know, where Galleria is and if there's more stories. So I won't press you on it. Because I'm totally invested in this, but I will just throw this idea out there. I love Farrier so much. It would be great to see her on some of her, you know, earlier cases, like maybe even her first case, how she cut her teeth. I think that would be so interesting to, cause then it would contrast with where she is in this story so well. So maybe someday.
not wanting to give away the game or anything, but, you are extremely right that would be interesting. And, I'll give away the game here. I have an idea for a Farrier sort of origin series.
Oh, awesome.
That takes us through the beginning of her career and then sort of touches on her three big cases. I would very much like to do it. It's one of the, it's shaping up really well. It's got a bunch of characters in it I'm really excited about, some of whom you've kind of seeded in just passing dialogue in the Lavender Jack series so far. And, it's definitely something I'm very interested in.
That's cool. That's really cool. Well, if it does come to fruition, we'll have to have you back on to, when it gets ready to drop, whether that's, you know, 2 years from now or whenever. I'd love to pick your brain about that.
That would be my pleasure.
Now let's talk a little bit about your relationship with Webtoon in particular. It's such a great platform. How did you come to bring the series to Webtoon and their digital platform?
Well, I was invited to pitch them something, and I had initially developed Lavender Jack as a conventional print comic miniseries, and so I sort of refabbed it a little bit for what I thought would fit for the Webtoon format, and I pitched that, and then, you know, Becca Caden, you know, kind of took it over and helped me. Like, at first I thought that the story that I've told so far would be like 10 episodes. Just because I didn't get it. I didn't understand that Webtoon panels don't work the way that comic book panels do.
Right.
You know, the flow is different. The way that the audience attention works is different. And to be clear, I'm not saying that Webtoon readers have like small attention span or anything. That's not it at all. It's more like in a print comic, as you're turning pages, there's these little circuits of information that have natural breaking points. But in Webtoon, where it's all scrolling, like in a comic, you can jump to like four or five different locations in four or five pages. There's that neat natural page break. In a Webtoon, it's, you're looking at one long image. So it's jarring. It's upsetting. Mm-hmm. If you jump around a lot in a single episode. And so once Becca started really showing me the ropes, I realized the limitations of the format. But then I realized the strengths. I realized the intimacy that the format provides. How after decades of comics making long horizontal panels and saying that it's cinematic, Webtoon has created an actually cinematic form of comics. The way you absorb the information is much closer to a movie or a TV show. But you have the complete power over the flow of time that you get in a comic book. So I went from just being excited at the possibility of having Lavender Jack published after being very excited about publishing it with Webtoon specifically.
Yeah, and I've said this to other creators that have come on too. It's you just because of, and it's not that any of the panels have motion in them, but just due to kind of the nature of as you read it, you're scrolling, you can play with things like reveals and as you said, time, you know, by leaving bigger spaces between the panels, and you kind of get a little bit of the advantage of what motion comics bring to the story. And I think that it's a very unique format. And I'm surprised as a long time traditional comic reader, how quickly I noticed the advantages and how quickly I got excited, you know, as a reader saying, wow, this is something really different and something that really works well.
I'm right there with you. Just today, I was reading the most recent update of Milvina's Therapy by, I wrote it down because I knew I was going to be talking about it, by A. Rassen. And, it's this horrifying comic. It's a horror comic. And the thing I noticed as like a pretty terrifying, grisly reveal happens, I felt in a good way, in a positive way, kind of betrayed by the process of reading the comic, because I was moving my finger. I was moving myself through the story. And then I came across this horrifying thing. And it was almost like, comic, I trusted you. I trusted you that if I just sort of kept scrolling, I'd be safe. And then you went and did this to me. You made me culpable in a jump scare. It was like those internet videos your friends would send you, where it's like, click on this picture of a house, and it's a horror face.
Yep.
It makes you engaged in the process of moving through the story in a way that makes jokes funnier, that makes, obviously, scares scarier. And it, if you're scrolling through an action comic, you can, pick up the pace of the action as you're reading, because you want to know who wins. You want to know if your guy can get out from under. So you start scrolling faster. It's tremendously cool.
Yeah, it really is. And one thing that I wonder about is people who maybe discovered comics through Webtoon, if they take that for granted, as opposed to guys like us who grew up reading the traditional and really see it for kind of the innovation it is. It would be interesting to talk to people. Next time I go to a convention where Webtoon has some panels, I'm going to have to ask that question. Maybe we'll get a show of hands or something, because it's so interesting to me, because it is such a – here it is. It's all comics, right? It's all sequential art, but it's just the experience is so different.
I would be very interested to hear what some of those responses are. I've been doing Lavender Jack for over 6 months now, and I only just feel like I'm starting to understand the culture of Webtoon readership. It's first of all, an incredibly supportive, enthusiastic group of people. I was afraid to read the comments at first. A couple months went by where I didn't read the comments because I didn't want it to get in my head.
Right.
But now I went in the comic posts, I check a couple times a day to read new ones. And the people who comment, the Lavender Jack readers who comment on the comic week to week, they're insightful. They pay attention. If I put a relevant picture on the wall in episode 9, they're going to remember it in episode 26. And that is, as a writer, especially, a young writer like me, I'm still pretty green. I don't have a big following or anything. And so to have people who care about what I'm writing that much, take that active a role in reading it is thrilling.
Yeah. It's kind of like you're getting the best parts of the comics community without the cynicism, right?
It's true. Now, I know that, when you're getting like every episode of Lavender Jack right now gets, I think, like between 2,500 and 3,000 likes. And I know that when you're getting, tens of thousands and, 1,000 comments, whenever you become bigger, I imagine it becomes more stressful and whatnot. So I don't want to I don't want to make it sound like, you know, Rachel is having a totally painless experience with Lore Olympus, just because I'm having a great time with Lavender Jack. But, I know that my Webtoon creator experience, when it comes to the readers has been, I have zero complaints.
Yeah. You know, I had, Uruchan on to talk about Unordinary, and she was talking kind of about the same thing. She's like, yeah, in the beginning when I got a few hundred comments, it was great. I'd read every one and it was awesome, and I don't want to make it seem like I'm not just as grateful now for the thousands and thousands of comments that I have when episodes come out now, but it's not the same situation. She's like, I can't go through and read every single comment that, you know, I wish I had time, but I'm busy making the strip. You know, if I went and read all 10,000 comments for the latest episode, I wouldn't have time to make the strip. So, yeah, I mean, it's like anything, you know, in moderation. But she's, you know, very grateful for the community of fans that she has. And another thing she mentioned is how great the community of Webtoon creators are. Have you had a chance to meet any other Webtoon creators and experience what that community is like?
Yeah, they had a rooftop party at San Diego Comic-Con this past year that I went to.
Oh, I was there. And, we were there. I did.
You were.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll be there again this
that's
year.
That's crazy.
It'll be great to meet face to face, but go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, that'll be great. No worries. It was definitely a very, a warm, friendly group of people, blah, blah, blah. But it was also a group of like serious people. People who are taking this seriously and who are, they're making a living out of it because they've made a living out of it, not because it was handed to them. And that is, like, being around people who are that hardworking is what I loved about working in a studio environment. And it's what I look for in friends. And that's like, Webtoon people are like the modern day, you know, Eisner and Iger studio comic artists. They're bent over the table 10 hours a day making this comic. I've also been fortunate because I've become friendly with other Webtoon creators, but also I've had my friends become Webtoon creators. I'm friends with Paul Tobin, who does Messenger with Ray Nadine. I'm friends with James Maddox, who's doing Metaphorical Her. With David Stoll. So a Discover comic that's getting some buzz, Midnight Furies, that's by my friend Jess Heron. So I've both met new people that I can reach out to for advice, and I've become the people my friends reach out to for advice when it comes to Webtoon.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And yeah, that's one last thing that I wanted to ask you about is, would you recommend Webtoon as a platform for aspiring creators? You know, they do have, as you said, the Discover side of things where, you know, you can, as long as you're producing the work, you know, you can put it up there. There's no like obligations. You're not going to be making page rate, but Webtoon is constantly looking for good content to bring over to the feature side. So is it something that you would recommend? I mean, even if it's an aspiring creator who wants to get in on the more traditional print side of things, is to give Webtoon a try?
I definitely would recommend it with the following caveats. It's a lot of work. The comic that I produce is the equivalent of about 7 pages of content a week. And I don't just pencil and ink it. I also letter it. I write it. I promote it. I'm like the assistant editor on the book. I also, like, I manage Jen. When we have a guest artist, I manage that person or those people, as the case may be. And I have to do it every week. If I miss a week because I'm sick or injured or something, like, I got to put something up there too. I got to put up a Q&A or something, which I like doing. It's not a hard existence in the sense that it's hard on me, like that I don't like it, because I do. I like it a lot. But to say that it's easy would be disingenuous. It's I liken it to almost being like an indie circuit wrestler. It's hard on you after a while, and if you don't love it, you won't be able to keep doing it. So there's that. Is it a good way to get work as a traditional cartoonist? I don't know that either, because I worked in mainstream comics before I came to Webtoon, and I don't know if Lavender Jack is going to translate into further mainstream work. I don't know. What I do know is that the only way you get good at comics is by making a bunch of comics, and being held to a weekly deadline is a great way to level up your skill. So if you can hack it, if you don't mind, if you don't mind being Rocky working out in the like drafty gym, if you don't mind punching meat in the fridge, then yeah, it's really good, and you're going to get a lot out of it.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that, it's a couple things actually that, as kind of a layman that I look at, putting out a Webtoon comic can show a couple of things. First of all, it shows your talent, right? If it's good, and if it does show that you're willing to work hard and meet deadlines, because as you said, it is, a lot of work. And I think thirdly, it shows that you're not falling behind that excuse that so many aspiring creators do fall behind. Like, I don't know how to get my comic out there. I don't know how to get my ideas out there. There's no excuse. It's never been easier to create comics, to create sequential art and sequential storytelling and get it out there. I mean, I've talked to so many guys that broke in, before the age of the internet, so to speak. Mark Silvestri is one that immediately comes to mind, and Mark Brooks as well. And they both say there's no excuse. It's never been easier to just create something, whether you're a writer or an artist, and put it out on the internet. And if it's good, people will find you. There's no excuse. You don't have to travel around to conventions. You don't have to live in New York and go show your samples at Marvel and DC like you used to. So I think that Webtoon is a platform that really can showcase those three things really well. So again, if you're an aspiring creator, I do recommend, just as Dan said, that to, give it a try. Just remember that it is work. And like a lot of things in life, you're going to get out of it what you're willing to put into it. Would you say that's true, Dan?
That's 100% true. And like everything else in life, why would drawing comics be a job? Like, why would that be something that can sustain you? It's a strange thing. It almost feels like a mistake, but it can be your job. It can sustain you, but sort of in exchange for this wonderful job existing, you have to love it. You have to commit to it. It won't meet you halfway.
That's a good
point. And if you want to do something, even in like the sub basement of the entertainment industry that is working in comics, you got to put yourself there and keep yourself there, because if you're going to slack off, somebody is going to take your place.
Yep, there's always the next generation wanting to come up and give it a try.
And also it's fun and fulfilling, and the readers are really great. non-dire baby boomer talk also applies to this. Yes,
exactly. Exactly. And you get to come on the Comic Source and talk about your creation. So there's that as well.
I mean, that's the zenith right there. That's the best of it.
Well, Dan, I really want to thank you for your time. I'll give you the opportunity. If you have anything else that you want to share with our listeners, past work that they can go and pick up, or really anything you'd like to say.
Well, if people want to know what I'm up to, they can pop over to Twitter. I'm at Dan Scadde. That's DanScadde. If you want to check out some of my mainstream work, you can pick up The Spirit Returns, which is a 12-issue series starring Will Eisner's The Spirit that I drew. Matt Wagner wrote it. Brendan Wagner colored it. It is probably now that I'm working on Lavender Jack, it's the second most fun I've ever had in comics.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, again, thanks for your time, Dan. Listeners, if you want links to Dan's social media, go check the show notes. I'll put a link to his Twitter. Again, Dan, best of luck with the strip. It's great. I love it. I can't wait to see how it ends up. And yeah, I'm definitely in for a prequel with Madame Ferrier. So keep that in mind.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You bet. My pleasure.